Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk, a show dedicated to exploring all aspects of creating a great dental office, where the only dumb question is the question that's not asked. Here's Jim and Han.
Good evening, Jim Jarvis here, and along with me, my co-host Han. How are you tonight, Han?
I am marvelous, Jim. How are you doing?
Excellent, excellent. Well, tonight we've got a really interesting, in-depth, and one of those, oh my gosh, are we really going to talk about this subjects? The subject of episode number 20, which is right, 20 episodes, Hod. Think about that. We've got 20 episodes under our belt. Well, that's actually kind of cool. Yeah. What do you do when your contractor goes in the wrong direction? In a nice way, oh crap. Well, we have been involved in so many very successful projects where you have, I want to say, some of the best contractors in the area, in the country. And when you work with a professional like that, that really knows what they're doing and how they should put things together and how they should communicate, you know, it is just it's a pleasure. It's a joy. And you can really, really, really see how it affects the quality of the project, but also helps the project get done in a timely fashion. But there's a few times, and over the many, many years that Han and I have been in this business, we've seen it where, you know, the contractor, the owner, the architectural relationship has been eroded. It turns into a condition that it really affects the success of the project. And it gets to the point of, what do you do? And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. What do you do? You know, this is a sensitive topic, and please feel free. Give us a call on our call-in number of 457-383-1442 if you want to ask us a direct question. But we'll try to hit all the highlights in tonight's hour-long show about what we want to discuss. But this sensitive subject is, and remember, Han and I are not attorneys. I'm an architect. Han's a designer. We've been involved in this for years and years and years. We see what's going on from a professional standpoint and how best to maybe cut this kind of stuff off at the pass and provide a situation that maybe you don't run into that. So I guess the first question I want to ask is, how do you get into a problem with a contractor? Well, the first thing you want to make sure of is you want to make sure that you have a contract. Please go back and listen to some of our previous episodes about who does what and where and all those kind of fun things, but you must have a contract, a written signed agreement that outlines every aspect of what is to be done. If you don't do that, you're asking for trouble day one. It need to have clear documents. We've all heard those things. Well, you can just draw that up on a napkin and let the contractor take it from there. No, please don't do that. Please don't allow that to happen, because it is actually just a recipe for total disaster. Hon?
How about a handshake, Jim? Does that exist anymore?
No, it doesn't. Unfortunately, not in this day and age. A person's word should be their promise, but in reality, if it's not written down on that piece of paper, it's not enforceable. So the next is, make sure you have clear and concise lines of communication. The lines of communication talk about everything, and it needs to be outlined, and who does what, when, where. And who's responsible for what, when, where. And that should be in that contract, and you should make sure they go over that. So, again, go back, listen to those previous podcasts that we have that talk about those kind of things, but at least at a minimum, have those items in place to help minimize getting yourself into a situation where, you know, your contractor and you, your relationship erodes, or your contractor heads in the wrong direction. Because both of with me, both of which mean disaster for your project success. So let's say everything's failed. Everything's come to the point where things just have eroded. You're not getting what you expect to be getting, and you're sitting there wondering, okay, what do I do next? You know, this relationship is soured to the point that I as the owner, don't know what to do. Well, the very first thing that we would recommend, and we always recommend, is you set the team down together in a group that includes, you know, the owner, the architect, the designer, the accountant, the lawyer, the contractor, and other parties. Go back to that core episode we talked about your core group. You set everybody down at the table and try to resolve the issues. Find out what they are. And in that communication, hopefully you'll be able to at least identify what is causing the problem. You know, is it an issue where the contractor is not paying his subcontractors? Well, why is that? Is it a situation where the contractor is not performing and putting in product or materials or labor that is of the quality that you need to have it? Why is that? Identify that. Maybe you can resolve the issue by that identification and be able to then say, okay, this is what we need to do to rectify that. Can we do that and work through those issues? Because at least at that point, you give it a try. Because after that point, it gets very, very messy. And, you know, Han and I don't want to paint a picture of this is like, oh my gosh, the worst thing that could ever happen to you. But it could be one of the worst things that ever happened. Right?
But, Jim, we should. I mean, it is when you engage into a construction project, you know, it's not that you need to pray, but you know, you're optimistic there and you do your best to manage your time, your resource, your team, and you hope that everything comes together, you know, according to the plan. But things do happen. So this episode is not about painting the gloom and doom of a project. But, you know, things do happen, and it have. When things happen, how do you resolve it? And move forward so that it doesn't repeat itself, and it minimize further expenditure and exposure. So yeah, it's like Jim said, it's a topic that's so sensitive. It's kind of scary, but it needs to be discussed. So at least you have. If you don't have any fear, you can be in trouble. Okay, and this is one of those things like, oh my God, how do we get things in proper order so we can get the job done? So
right.
I think it's a necessary conversation.
Well, it is a necessary conversation. It's one of those things that you prepare for the worst and plan for the best. So what we're trying to help is be prepared. Be prepared for the what if, and then hope it doesn't happen. And if you're lucky enough to be able to have a great team and you have one of those wonderful contractors, you don't even have to worry about this. It's a mute point, and that's something that never comes up, and everything is a success at the end of the day. But if you can't get a resolution at that sit down, then it's really time to do the very first thing, and that is review your contract. Go to the contract that you had to have had done before, as we stated in the first part of this show. For example, the AIA contract, which is document A201, it's the general conditions for the contract for construction, outlines terminations. It's under Article 14, specifically 14.2, talks about termination by the owner for cause. Now, there are, again, Han and I are attorneys. This is stuff that you have to review with your attorney. There are other terminations that are part of Article 14 that have to do with the contractor able to terminate the contract and those kind of things. But we're not talking about that subject tonight. What we're talking about is this, that the contractor went off base, fell off the tracks and is headed in a different direction, and it's not what you're expecting.
No, Jim.
Yes.
Could you explain the importance of the type of contract to use?
Well, there is an extreme amount of litigation and review and history and case law that have been hashed out under the AIA documents. So these documents have been around for years and years and years. They have been adjusted. They have been modified. They have been tweaked to cover all instances and cases to as best as possible. So we would always recommend that you utilize a AIA contract, meaning the American Institute of Architects contract, as opposed to a contract that the contractor comes up with. Maybe one that he likes to use because it's his favorite contract. You may not be as well protected in that contractual arrangement as well. The AIA contract, again, like I said, has the case law behind it, where it is basically created to protect you, the owner, as much as possible without being maybe weighed heavily to the contractor or to any other party that's underneath that. That's why we also recommend the AIA documents for between the contracts between the owner and the architect for that same reason. Everybody's protected and everybody's protected fairly. So I hope that answers the question, Han.
Yep.
Excellent.
Well, because I think it's – go ahead, Jim.
No, let's say, you know, it is crucial that at least we talk about that one aspect about it, so that you know today that if you were to enter into a contractual relationship, one of your first questions should be to the contractor is this an AIA contract? And if he says no or she says no, then you ask why not. And you better have a pretty good darn reason, because there's no reason to jeopardize or put yourself out at more risk than necessary. Obviously, any good lawyer is going to tell you that, and you'd ask them that same reason. Well, let's talk about why in the world would you want to terminate your contract with your contractor? Well, there's some big reasons, but before we do that, let's talk about being – Han, how'd you put it? What are the best ways to identify, or what are the red flags that come up that say, oh, we may be getting ourselves into trouble? Yeah. Well, the first is
basically seeing the smoke,
exactly.
Where there's smoke, there's a fire.
Yeah. And what do those smoke signals look like? Not to use the terminology, but, you know, what do they look like? Well, the very first one that we are always very cognizant of is, are the subcontractors getting paid? If you or anyone else in your team get any indication that a contractor has not paid their subcontractors and they're not paid up to date, or their suppliers are not paid up to date, you know, within a 30-day period, because typically billing cycles are 30 days. If you have any indication that you have that, that is a major red flag. That's a, oh, crap, we better check into this. You know, stop the presses, call the team together, find out what's going on. Because that is a major indicator that there is a problem, and that problem might just be the contractor. And it may be a financial one. Go ahead.
There's two things that I can think of that will give you some hint that there is something amiss. Okay, one is that they didn't provide you with a lien waiver when you pay them. Okay, a lien waiver is a document that certified that they actually had paid the sub or the supplier. That's just so, because that's a document that helped to protect you from somebody, whether it's supplier or the sub, putting a lien on your project.
That covers the previous month's payment. So that lien waiver is for last month's payment. So it's a insurance document that it's like a receipt / insurance document that says that contractor paid that subcontractor on your behalf for the work that they did on your project. So that subcontractor does not have the ability to come back after the fact and say, I was never paid. I'm placing a lien on your project and I'm going to squeeze you until I get the money that I'm owed.
So. Yep. The other one is that you don't see a worker on your project for days out. Because typically if the contractor, GC, doesn't pay the sub, they won't come to the job. Right? That's what we have seen. For me, that's the two indication that there is problem. Lack of worker on the site and a lack of lien waiver being provided for the payment from the previous work.
Right. And that first one, the lack of workers or lack of laborers, could be just a matter of, well, this is a project that, let's say, should really have 10 or 15 drywallers on the job and there's only two. So that tells you that, okay, this may be a problem. That may be the beginning of a problem. And that's when you bring it up to the rest of your team and say, I was out on the job the other day and there was only two cars there. And there were just two guys and they were supposed to, obviously they're supposed to be doing, you would think logically they'd be doing a whole lot more work by a whole lot more contractors trying to get, or subcontractors trying to get that accomplished. And that kind of talks about, go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, majority of the time, I mean, it's the contractor that work on your project may have a couple of projects going on at the same time. That also applies to the sub. Everything happened in progression. So if you, before they put up the drywall, there's electrical and plumbing and perhaps heating that goes into the wall. So your utilities. If you see plumbing that being rough and it just kind of sit in the same status for weeks, there is problem, and you want to at least inquire about it. Don't wait until after everybody's off the job to inquire about it. But yeah, the lack of one or two worker on the site is not a big issue. But if there is work that needs to be done and it's not getting done for days or weeks, and where everybody else wait their turn, that to us, so to me at least, that's the beginning of an inquiry that should be asked. What's going on and what's happening with it? And don't wait until you really have a big problem.
Right. And those inquiries should be done in writing.
Absolutely.
Again, must have a paper trail. So the very first item under termination when it comes to termination by the owner for cause is repeatedly refuses to fail or fails to supply enough properly skilled workers or proper materials. So that's really what that's talking about, is you don't have enough people on the job to be able to do the work that's necessary, and it's going to affect the success of the project. The second one is fails to make payments to the subcontractors for material or labor and in accordance with the agreement with the contract and subcontractors. So we talked a little bit about that, about making sure you have the lien waivers in place, those kind of red flags. If you don't have a lien waiver when you have your pay application for the previous month's pay, that's a red flag. That's a problem. It needs to be checked into. One of the things that Han and I would look at, because obviously there's areas where the owner would probably see some possibilities of issues that might be coming up, but red flags for Han and I are going to be, has the contractor installed or purchased products or materials without getting the shop drawings submitted and approved by us and our engineering team? That is a major red flag as to a potential issue with your contractor and them going in a different direction.
Jim, briefly explain what shop drawing is.
Oh, well, shop drawing is, and again, go back to our previous episodes and podcasts about the documents and those kind of things. But a shop drawing is, let's say you have a piece of equipment on the roof that's a HVAC. It's a heating and air conditioning unit. Okay, it has been specified in the drawings as to exactly what it will be, how big it will be, how many BTUs, how many, what the electrical requirements are, how much gas needs to go into it or electricity, how much heat it will produce, how much air conditioning you produce, how it will be hooked up, what's its physical size, what it needs to sit on, all those kind of very detail-oriented, kind of like the same thing you get for a dental chair, but more sophisticated in the sense of where it's at. Also, there'll be detailed instructions on how it needs to be installed to keep it under warranty. Now, all of that is given to us and our team. We review it. The general contractor should also review it, make sure it's the appropriate one that was specified in the contract documents, our drawings. Then it is stamped and approved, and then the contractor should purchase it and get it delivered on the site and eventually have it installed. Now, if they fail to do the step of getting the shop drawing approved, that smacks of us that they're putting product or material into the project that is not in line with the contract documents. So that falls under the item of, okay, you pay for X, but you're getting Y. And that is a cause for termination, one of the issues. And so it could be the beginning. It could be just a simple mistake. It's all crap. We forgot to do that. Or I thought that got sent over to you and it didn't. Well, you know, some things like that, you know, we're all human. Accidents do happen. And sometimes those things get missed. But if you start see a pattern of that, that's an issue. Please be aware of that. We're always aware of it. And when you have your meetings with your contractor and your architect and the job superintendent, you know, you ask that question, okay, where are the shop drawings at? Where are we at on shop drawing submittals? All those things. Because if your architect doesn't ask for that, then you ask for it and make sure that your architect knows that you expect him to do his job and review those. But at the same time, you're saying to the builder, the contractor, we expect you to provide those so that we know what's being built, how it's being built, with what. So that kind of falls under the area of lack of performance. Okay. Now, another part of the performance is the aspect of, in the contract, the contractor should have given you a schedule. And that schedule is a construction schedule of how long it's going to take to do this project. How long is it going to take to build the building from start to finish and what the steps are intermediately between A and B? How long is it going to take to do the drywall? How long is it going to take to do the foundations, item after item? Now, if your architect or your team is noticing that the contractor is not able to follow or is not following that schedule, there, you could have an issue of a lack of performance, meaning that they're not putting enough workers on the job. Like Han said, it's very true. Numerous contractors may have two or three or four projects going on at the same time. And so are they over at Project A with all their subcontractors when they should have some of their subcontractors at your project working on your project at the same time, and they're not, because they're, maybe they're behind over on project A, and they should be over working on your project. So lack of performance is crucial, and also one of the cases for termination. The other is failure to correct defective work. And that falls under the category under the AIA contract of persistently disregards laws, ordinance, or rules, regulations, or orders of the public authority having jurisdiction. Along with the last one that talks about substantially breaches the provisions of the contract documents. So if it's found out that a particular product is placed into your building, let's say they utilized an inferior substrate under the cabinet work and covered it up with the cabinet finish. Let's say, you know, it's a plastic laminate that covers over top of the a particle board.
Particle board.
We've seen that before. When in fact the specifications, when in fact the specifications call for a high density MDF or even plywood. Well, that's an inferior product placed in the project, and it needs to be rectified. Now, if the contractor will not rectify that, those become areas of potential termination with the contractor. So, again, failure to correct that work once it's been identified. Now, a further review of this number three item there, disregard of laws, ordinance. If it's found that, let's say, you know, Han and I are not the only ones that are out there observing the project as it's being done under construction. You have inspectors from the city, from the state, from the federal government, all have jurisdiction and authority over your particular project. The fire marshal, all those folks are out there, and if they have identified that the contractor has done something that's not to their requirements and specifications, and he or she fails to fix that and rectify that, that's another grounds for termination. Because effectively he is breaking his contract with you to provide a building that is basically meets the approval of the permit and the approval of the local authority. Because the bottom line is, you will never get your permit, your certificate of occupancy, if these areas are not rectified. So to be able to be in a position that the contractor says, well, I'm not going to install that drywall, fire-rated drywall product that was specified on there. I'm just going to put in a normal drywall product and see if, because a lot of times it can't be identified. But there are ways. And it's found out that they put an inferior product, and the building inspector says, no, that needs to be fire-rated drywall, and they won't repair that. That is a issue twofold. One, you're getting inferior product, but two, you'll never get your CO, your construction occupancy permit, because it doesn't meet the code. Your building will not be useful to you. So that is a serious cause for termination, and it would need to be rectified. You were going to say, huh?
No, it's actually, I like you saying that when product is installed, okay, for the general public, the building owner, we're not going to assume that you, the building owner, are savvy or knowledgeable about construction, the process, the material, and the system, and all that stuff. But there is way to identify either defective and or substituted material. When things are not done in accordance to the specification, to the design, to the code, and all that stuff, it's a serious issue. I mean, you have some municipalities are so strict that if the design call out for, let's say, your lawn, the property around the building to be sodded, and you decide to seed, okay, they can make you sod the property, the lawn, before they give you the certificate of occupancy. Okay, so, adherence to and comply to the specifications, all the zoning, all the codes, and all that stuff is very pertinent. And that job usually falls squarely on the shoulder of the contractor that was hired to put all this together.
Now, you bring up a very important point when it comes to in discussion with the building department or the authority, the government authorities. Your building department is the one that is giving you the building permit. Okay. You, as the owner, are the one, you're the entity that the permit is based on. That is given to you as the owner, not to the builder. The builder doesn't hold the permit. He is an entity that's part of the permit, but he is not the holder of the permit. So you have the permit. It's under your name specifically for your project, for your use. And if for some reason what's down the road, it is determined that your contractor has to be terminated for cause, whatever that cause is, you then have the right to go back to the building department and say, okay, I had to terminate my contractor. Here's the reasons why. Here's the documentation around it. And I have now hired a new contractor to finish the work. That new contractor's name would be placed on the permit and verified that that contractor is, in fact, legal to do work within the city. For example, some cities require that you have your contractors licensed in that particular city or that particular state. But you have the right to do that. So don't ever let anybody tell you that, you can't finish this project because you don't have the permit. I do. No. You are the owner of the permit. That permit is in your name, and you can very easily go down to the building department and let them know that you've changed the contractor out because of these particular reasons and continue to move the project forward. So it's just a sidebar, but it's an important point that you understand you're in control.
Just a tidbit too, Jim. The permit, when it's granted to you for the construction of your project, whether it's a building or a tenant space, that permit is technically a contractual agreement between you, the owner, and the city, meaning that you agree to build whatever it is specified and drawn on the document that was submitted to the city. So if there's, it's crucial that you stick to that, to the agreement and don't deviate. If you deviate or need to, then you need to at least update the document with the city. That the architect on your project will take care of that task, but never take the position that you got the permit, nobody's going to know, and you're going to make the changes because you're the owner and you have the right to do that, and so on, because even after you get the certificate of occupancy and you decide to modify the building, the interior building and things like that, what you actually did is you breached the contract. That contract is an ongoing document with the, building official or the jurisdiction. So it's just almost like a living document. You should keep it. Stick to the program. And if you have to make changes, make sure that it's done legally. Okay.
Right. So because you're right, Han. It goes on forever, in the sense that, let's say that the building department's regulations say that you have to have a drinking fountain. It's part of the rules and regulations for your particular use group, and you have to have a drinking fountain. You can't go in and say, oh, okay, I'll install the drinking fountain today, and then after I get my certificate of occupancy, I'm going to take the drinking fountain out and put something else there, because that was my intent. Well, actually, you've broken the contract with the building department, which is in basically it's forever. And they have the ability, whenever they do their inspections periodically through the years, that if it's noted and identified, they can rescind your certificate of occupancy and basically kick you out of their building, that you can't occupy it. So it's serious stuff. You can't just go in and say, I'm going to do this, and then turn around and come back and do something else later. That's kind of another sidebar, but it is very serious.
Yeah, this topic, it came up in discussion from time to time with downtown, is that, you know, the building, once you're done with the construction of the building, you get the certificate of occupancy, the building official not going to, come back into your building and inspect it. In some aspect, it's true. However, the building, when we say building official, we're not just talking about the building inspector. We're talking about the entire team from the city. It could be your fire marshal, because they do look, you know, they have to sign off on your project. They see the project. They're familiar with the project. They're also quite familiar with the code. So if they go in once or twice a year to do a fire inspection, just make sure that all your fire extinguishers are up to date, functioning, and all that good stuff. And they see that this is a brand new building or relatively new. It's supposed to have a drinking fountain. It's no longer there. They go back to the office and say, hey, Joe, building official, I saw so-and-so. Could you check it out? And, I mean, the snowball effect would be devastating. Like Jim said, sometimes they just come in and tell you, hey, you violate this, put it back in. Sometimes they just simply go in and lock your door. Shut you down.
Exactly.
Okay.
So let's say you've gotten to the point that your contractor was unable to sit down and come to an agreement and resolve the issues, and you had to terminate them. You had to break that relationship for whatever cause. And how do you actually do that? Well, in the AIA document, it's laid out specifically as to what has to be done. It's always done in writing. It has a certain timetable, as in how many days. In this particular one, it says 7 days written notice, so that they understand that in 7 days they have to turn over the possession of the site, the material, everything that's on that project that's owned by the contractor, and it then allows you to take possession of the property, the building, at whatever point it's done, and then move forward in whatever reasonable method you want to move forward with to get the project finished. And then that's the next thing we want to do, is how do you, in fact, get the project finished? Here you are, partially done with your project. It's one of those, oh, crap moments. What do I do next? Well, the very first thing you do is you have to get together with your team and with your banker and with the architect and review the current pay apps and the funds that are available. So pay applications are those things that every month are prepared by the contractor and says that last month I did all of these things and I have all this material on the job. And I would like to have X to pay for that. So contractors are always paid 30 days after the fact. Never, and this is another sidebar, and Han and I will talk a little bit about that. Never, ever, ever do a project where you're paying money up front to a contractor. That is the quickest way. That's one of the biggest, fattest red flags you could ever think of, that you're going to get yourself into trouble. Back to, we talked about those other previous red flags about, oh, crap, this is, these are some of those moments that this may not be going to go well. Well, that's one that's not going to potentially go well. The rules, the normal way of doing things is contractors are paid 30 days after the fact. Pay applications are processed for work done to date, product material supplied on the job or potentially off-site in secure locations. That's what's paid for, and it's done 30 days after the fact. So you have protections there. And on top of that, you also keep a percentage, what we call retainage. Typically, it's around 10%. It's outlined in your contract, but that percentage of retainage is there to use as if things were to go sideways down the road, you could then rectify some of the issues with that retainage once you're able to determine what needs to be done. But please, 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 we can't state it anymore. Do not ever pay a contractor upfront for any portion of the work. Get another contractor. Wouldn't you say, Han?
Jim? Yeah, the retainage that Jim is talking about, it is your leverage. It is your only leverage besides the contract. What Jim mentioned about never pay your contractor up front. Now, I've been in discussion with other counties where the debate is whether you pay the contractor that you're thinking about hiring who requests to have 20, 30, or 50% of the construction cost up front before he starts. Like Jim say, you're not seeing smoke, you're seeing fire. If a contractor are not financially stable enough to be in business, let's say you're going to do a renovation or build out, and that the construction contract is, let's just easy math, $500,000, and he's asking for 50% of that. That's $250,000 that the contractor have not done anything for. He have not buy one single nail for your project, and you give him a $250,000 check. Let me say this again. That will be the worst mistake you can ever make on your project for your office, because if the contractor have financial trouble, whether it's personal or professional, and you need that money and you also need that money, more than likely your project is going to be $250,000 short. And if you don't have the means to make up that difference while you litigate to try to get that back from the contractor who had walked off, your project is dead in the water. So don't ever, I wouldn't even go with 10%. You do not give any money up front at any time.
Yeah.
We can't stress the importance of that.
0%. Yeah. And if they say they have to have it, then you need to make sure that that reason, whatever that reason is ironclad. I, to this date, I've been doing this for over 30 years, and I cannot tell you one instance when there was a reason why someone had to have a percent of money up front to
I have.
Do a project
from a general
contractor side.
Yeah. Actually, the project that I was involved in my previous life, it was an industrial project, and the equipment that's needed for that building has an extremely long lead time, and they need to order it in advance. And so the check was written to buy that, you know, buy that piece of equipment so that it can be manufactured and be on site on time for the construction. But those instances are very rare for a dentist's office. That should never happen.
Right. That should never happen. And in reality, that's a very unique site-specific kind of application. And in reality, you're not giving the money to the general contractor. you're giving the money directly to the manufacturer of that particular piece of equipment. Okay, so that kind of makes sense, but you're right, Han, that'll never happen in a dental office.
I like you say, I don't see any reason for a dentist to write a check for anything up front. Because everybody on the project that's involved in the construction side, unless you hire, let's say, the cabinet maker individually on a separate contract, that's a different thing. And the cat, you know, but otherwise they usually are the sub of the general contractor. So if a cabinet maker say I need 20% upfront to buy the material, then that 20% upfront come from the contractor, not from the owner. Okay, because your contract is with the general contractor, not with the sub. So, you know, however you want to work with the scenario is, again, you don't give any money up front. You pay for what the work has already been done, because that's the only leverage you have. Money up front is almost like a giveaway.
Yeah. You're putting yourself at great risk. So let's get back to the aspect of, all right, you reviewed all your applications, your payment apps. You have an understanding of what you currently have on the job, how much work you have done, how much money you have left, plus the retainage that you talked about, to be able to say, okay, this is what I have left to build, to finish my project. Then you go out, you basically bid the remaining work and effectively hire yourself another contractor to move forward. Now, that costs some time and energy. One of our recommendations would be, and we've done this before very successfully, is that you could very quickly hire yourself. Let's say you have a general contractor arrangement, and it's a standard general contractor arrangement where the subcontractors work for the general contractor, and that general contractor is giving you a lump sum of, let's say, $1 million, and I'm going to build your building. So what we would recommend is, if you had to terminate the general contractor, is then go back, have a select a construction manager, someone who could manage this for you, and have that entity contact the individual trade contractors or the subcontractors, the drywallers, the plumbers, the electricians, the people that have worked on your project, the ones that haven't caused the issue. Let's say your plumber is doing a great job. He's doing everything on time and doing a wonderful job. Then you would be in your best interest to move forward with letting them finish the project. But let's say the electrician is a problem. That electrician never could supply enough people out there. He was always getting tagged by the inspector as putting stuff in inferior or incorrectly, or wasn't putting it in per code. You want to make sure you can keep that electrician off the job. You'd want to get another electrician on the job. And you would go, you'd have that project manager go through all the subcontractors and see who would want to finish the project out. 9 times out of 10, most of those subcontractors are going to say, yes, I want to finish this project out, because most of them have a high quality and high pride in their work, and they want to see what they've done, that they started. They want to see it finished, and they want to see it being a success. And they're very knowledgeable about what has been done to date. So they have that the kind of value, a big value, that will allow you to get the project back on schedule pretty quickly, because they don't have to learn, have that learning curve of what was done here or what wasn't done there. They already know. So that would be one of our recommendations about what you would do and how you would try to do that if you had to actually terminate your general contractor. Did I miss anything on that, Han?
Yeah, this one. Yes, I agree with Jim, is that would be ideal. Some of the things that you may have to work out with the sub is in the event that the general contractor did not pay them. Therefore, there's money owed to them. By contract, you already paid for it once by giving to, you know, paying the general contractor, but if he didn't pay his sub, that puts you in a kind of awkward situation. So you have to negotiate that or work that out somehow. The incentive for the sub who've been involved in the project is they already know the project. They are familiar with the work. They know what needs to be done, what the remaining work needs to be done, and if they can finish it under a different contract. Now, they are basically working directly for the owner, and they know that they're going to get paid. Okay, so
in that particular case, 9 times out of 10, though, you will have to front to bring them up to date, and then you talk with your lawyer about what your remedies about going back after that general contractor and taking money out of their retainage and taking money out of them in a civil lawsuit if it exceeded the retainage amount to be able to pay them up. So it becomes a little messy, but that's your potential remedies. But it far
we actually did ran into that very same scenario a couple of years back, where the contractor actually took the money, didn't pay the sub, and the owner had to pay what the sub was owed. And hired them directly to finish the job. So, it's more money than what the owner or the project owner had anticipated or budgeted, but it allowed him to get the job done and then, take care of all the other litigation stuff afterward. Because it costs you more in lost in production. If you delay, the project until you litigate and get that resolved.
Yeah, because litigations could take a year. They could take more than a year. You don't want your project sitting for that long. And most building permits only have a year time frame anyways. Well, if you do not finish the project within a one-year period, you then have to go back in and reinstate that building permit. So... yeah, that's kind of a messy situation. I've personally seen it 3 times in my career, 30-plus years, where the contractor had to be terminated and the owners moved forward in 3 different directions, all of which were successful to one degree or another, and the project was finished. And to this date, everything is going fine with those particular projects. Some of them were successful in litigating with the previous contractor and getting some monies returned. Some were not. But that, unfortunately, that's the risk of doing business. And, we can't solve that, but you sure can put at least some checks and balances in the place to make sure it doesn't get too much out of hand, so that you don't run up, $500,000, $1 million worth of liability because you gave the contractor a whole bunch of money that he wasn't entitled to, and he left the project or you had to terminate him. So those checks and balances are in place. So to wrap this up in a nutshell, you have options. You have the ability to, at least at the beginning, try to set yourself up with your team so this never happens. But if the worst of worst does happen and you have to terminate your contractor, you at least have the knowledge and the beginning knowledge to be able to do it. Rely on your team to help you move forward with that and get the project finished with the replacement entity, and then let your legal team tell you what your options are about going back after the contractor for whatever the difference was. Have that paperwork in place. Keep everything in writing. Make sure that everyone understands what you expected of them up front. And if you do that kind of homework up front and have the right kind of team, you're going to minimize the possibility of this happening, but it does happen. And so there at least are some avenues that at least help you get out of this, out of the mess that you find yourself in, if you're in that particular situation, and be able to move forward, get that project finished, open those doors and start practicing dentistry in your new facility and get that step behind you. Anya, anything that we missed on that?
Yeah, one item, Jim. The contract that you put together, the AIA contract put together between you, the owner, and the general contractor, with the help of your attorney. Hopefully the attorney is well-versed in the construction industry. Even they may be well-versed in the construction industry. They are not contractor. They're not architects. It would be our advice is to engage and get advice from your architect to at least have a look over the contract and make sure that the verbiage, all of the major important items are covered, because that contract is between you and a contractor. You can't have enough second or third opinion to look at things to protect to help and protect you from any exposure. So we recommend that you have the architect be involved at least to look over the contract for you and with you and with your attorney.
Excellent point.
That's it, Jim.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. Well, in the last few minutes we have for tonight, Han, what is happening with the latest and greatest on Dentaltown? I know it's been 2 weeks since we had a show, so maybe there's been something you'd like to share with the listeners.
Actually, it's not a Dentaltown thing. I recently have a conversation with a client pertaining to pocket doors versus solid door. I was talking to a contractor.
Do you mean hollow core doors versus a solid door?
No. They're naturally in a in a commercial project. We typically. I don't want to say typically. We always specify solid wood door for the projects. Always.
Right.
So whether it's a swing door or a pocket door, the door itself will still need to be solid core.
Right.
In the past, I often say if there is a sound, if you're trying to control the sound, pocket door versus swing door wins. However, there is always exception. If you have a pocket door, usually it goes into your utility wall or the 12 o'clock wall. If your utility is at the 12 o'clock wall, you have a pocket door, there's two layers of wall at that location. So therefore, it does provide, in my opinion, approximately would say equal to or about the same level of sound isolation, where you have a pocket door or a swing door, because that pocket door is, that pocket in the wall is kind of buffered by an additional wall thickness. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yep.
Yeah, it does.
Okay. Okay, but one of the discussions that I have that kind of caught my, piqued my interest, and I go scratch my head and say, really, is that we typically specify hollow metal door frame for our pocket doors. The reason that I like that is because it's really clean, it's easy to install, and it allows the use of a, in my opinion, the only ADA compliant hardware. The most contractors are not familiar with it, and they're familiar with doing everything with wood casing. And so the comment was that using a hollow metal door frame for a pocket door would cost three times as much. And I would say, well, the argument is you still got the same door. The only you would have less hardware, and the only thing that you have different is instead of a a wood casing, you have a metal door frame. As the architecture entity, we normally don't shop for the product. But we figure that you got product and labor and all that. It probably should be, come out pretty even. Maybe a few, $50, $100 more, but never three, three or four times more. So that was just a discussion I have that I just want to share, is that a lot of time, it's always about how much things cost or supposedly things cost. I would recommend that you get the number in writing, and then you compare, and then you see whether it's worth the value to spend the extra money, or or stick to your gun and have what is best. In my opinion, it's the hollow metal door frame. Okay. That's my two cents of contribution.
Yeah, it's much more durable. The hollow metal door frame is going to take a lot more abuse. Sliding pocket doors historically are beat up pretty easily because they are a function of sliding versus something that is pivoting on a hinge where very little things touch very little things. On sliding doors, there's a lot that does. You have tracks, you have runners, you have guides. All of those things have moving and friction parts and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's pocket doors are wonderful in the right application, but you want to make sure that you specify the highest quality one. A cheap pocket door is a piece of junk, and
It only means that you enjoy spending money unnecessarily if you go cheap.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, a cheap pocket door basically is something that gets chucked into the wall and never comes out. Once it fails, it never is used again, and it's very expensive.
It's also known as a wall liner, right?
Yeah. It basically is never. It's not cost effective to try to fix. So in that particular case, if you're going to use a pocket door, get the very best hardware, get the very best that you can use, because you'll be very happy with it over the long haul from that kid. Well, obviously we've hit our time slot and we're a little bit over, but we hope that we have been at least able to shed a little light on this semi-touchy subject about what happens if your contractor goes in the wrong direction. Please feel free, if you have any questions, contact us. You can call us on our 800 number. That's 1-866-213-1268. You can go to our website, www.hjtdesign.com. We've got a new area in that where you can click on and specifically set a time slot to have a conference with myself, Han, or Bill, and you'll be able to work that around your schedule, and it'll work around our schedule. It's a pretty cool system, and it allows us to hopefully be in a position to be able to help you communicate and answer your questions. We're very thankful that you're able to spend a little bit of time with us and be one of our listeners. Our listenership is growing. We're getting quite a few listens, especially to the podcasts after the shows, and we're excited about that. We're excited about our upcoming episodes. We will be having another episode next week, so look forward to spending time with you then. And with that, everyone be safe, and hopefully you have a good week. Han?
I thank you for spending the evening with us. Until next time. Have a good evening.
You've been listening to HJT Design Radio Straight Talk with Jim and Han. To contact us and find out more info about upcoming shows, please log on to our website at www.hjtdesign.com. Until next time.